The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Well, since this program is playing on Election Day 2020, I hope you all have had the opportunity to get out and vote. Very important. Let's see what happens tonight. It ought to be an exciting evening. In any event, let's start off with the Reader's Digest, an article of national interest. Hey, like the election. Starts off with a picture of an African-American gentleman sitting in a wheelchair, and he has only one leg, and his artificial leg is lying across his lap. Now, that's kind of interesting, isn't it? Henry Dostry was in danger of losing his other leg. Saving Henry's last leg. Black patients lose limb to diabetes at three times the rate that others do. One doctor is on a mission to spare them this unjust fate. And since I'm diabetic, I can empathize with that, and I've been fighting an infection in my foot for almost a year. It was a Friday evening in the hospital after a particular grueling week when Foluso Fakharid, M.D., the only cardiologist in Bolivar County, Mississippi, walked into a room 336. Henry Dostry lay on a cot, his gray curls puffed on a pillow. Dr. Fakharid smelled the circumstances, a rancid whiff like dead mice. He asked Coerce to undress the wound on Henry's left foot, and then slipped on nitrile gloves to examine the damage. Henry's calf had swelled to nearly the size of his thigh. The tops of his toes were dark. His sole was yellow, oozing. Dr. Fakharid's gut clenched. It's rotten, he thought. He peeled off his gloves and read over Henry's chart. He was 67, had never smoked. His ultrasound results showed that the circulation in his leg was poor. Uncontrolled diabetes, it seemed, had constricted the blood flow to his foot, and without it, the infection would not heal. A surgeon had typed up his recommendation. It began. Mr. Dostry has limited options. Dr. Fakharid scanned the room. He was quick, piercing eyes, a shaved head, and at 38, the frame of an amateur bodybuilder. Henry was still, his mouth arched downward, and frayed eyebrows stood high above his lids, giving me a look of disbelief. Next to his cot stood a fresh-colored prosthesis, balancing on a black sneaker. "How'd you lose the other leg?" Dr. Fakharid asked Henry. Henry was tired, and a stroke had slowed his recall. Diabetes had recently taken his right leg below the knee. An amputation of his left would leave him in a wheelchair permanently. By the way, Dr. Falusa Fakharid is a black man. "How'd you lose the other leg?" Dr. Fakharid asked Henry. Henry was tired, and a stroke had slowed his recall. Diabetes had recently taken his right leg below the knee. An amputation of his left would leave him in a wheelchair permanently. Dr. Fakharid explained that he wasn't the kind of doctor who cuts. He was there because he could test circulation, get blood flowing, and try to prevent any amputation that wasn't necessary. He hated that doctors hadn't screened Henry earlier, when he'd had the stroke or lost his leg. "Your legs are twins," he said. "What happens in one happens in the other." Henry needed an immediate angiogram, an imaging test that would show blockages in his arteries. He also needed a revascularization procedure to clean them out, with a thin catheter that shaves plaque and tiny balloons to widen blood vessels. His foot was decaying fast. Dr. Fakharid had grown obsessed with legs, infuriated by the toll of amputations on African Americans. His billboards on Highway 61, running the Mississippi Delta, announced his ambitious Amputation Prevention Institute. Diabetics undergo 130,000 amputations each year. Often these amputees are from low-income and underinsured neighborhoods, and black patients lose limbs at a rate triple that of others. About 34 million people in America have diabetes, and Mississippi has some of the highest rates. The vast majority have type 2. Their bodies resist insulin, or their pancreas doesn't produce enough, making their blood sugar levels rise. Genetics plays a role in the condition, but so do obesity and nutrition. High-fat meals, sugary foods, and not enough fiber, along with little exercise, amplify the risk. Poverty can double the odds of developing diabetes, and it also dictates the chances of an amputation. One major study mapped diabetic amputations across California, and it found that the lowest-income neighborhoods had amputation rates 10 times higher than the richest. Dr. Fakharid's name is spelled F-A-K-O-R-E-D-E, I assume I'm pronouncing it correctly, who was born in Nigeria and moved to New Jersey as a teenager, came to practice in Mississippi 5 years ago. He has spent years studying health disparities. African Americans develop chronic diseases a decade earlier than their white counterparts. They are twice as likely to die from diabetes, and they live, on average, 3 years fewer. A growing body of evidence shows how racial biases throughout the medical system mean worse results for African Americans. Research also shows that black patients are more responsive to and more trustful of black doctors. Dr. Fakhraddin fantasized about building a cardiovascular institute and recounting a multidisciplinary team from electrophysiologist to podiatrist. But as they researched what it would take, he found a major barrier, a shortage of doctors in the Delta. Though Bolivar County was at the center of a diabetes epidemic, there wasn't a single diabetes specialist and endocrinologist within 100 miles. This is what uncontrolled diabetes does to your body. Without enough insulin, or when your cells can't use it properly, sugar courses through your bloodstream. Plaque builds up faster in your vessels' walls, slowing the blood moving to your eyes and ankles and toes. Blindness can follow, or dead tissue. Many can't feel the pain of blood-starved limbs. The condition destroys nerves. If arteries close in the neck, it can cause a stroke. If they close in the heart, heart attack. If they close in the legs, gangrene. Bolivar Medical Center, the local hospital, credentialed Dr. Fakhraddin, allowing him to consult on cases and do procedures in their facilities. His most complicated patients come in through the emergency room. Some arrive without any inkling that they have gangrene. One had maggots burrowing in sores. Another showed up after noticing his dog eating the dead flesh off the tips of his toes. Dr. Fakhraddin took a photo to add to his collection. It was a public health crisis, he said, and no one was talking about amputations and the fact what was happening was criminal. For decades, African Americans in the South struggled to find and afford health care. The American Medical Association excluded black doctors, as did its constituent societies. Some hospitals admitted black patients through back doors and housed them in hot, crowded basements. Many required them to bring their own sheets and spoons, or even nurses. Before federal law mandated emergency service for all, hospitals regularly turned away African Americans, some in their final moments of life. That's a shameful thing. In 2015, when Dr. Fakhraddin moved to Mississippi, the state had the nation's lowest number of physicians per capita. It had not expanded Medicaid to include the working poor. Across the country, 15% of African Americans were still uninsured, compared with 9% of white Americans. Vascular disease presents a special challenge. The Affordable Care Act mandates that insurers cover all primary care screenings that are recommended by the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, an independent panel of preventive care experts. The group, though, had not recommended testing anybody without symptoms, even the people most likely to develop vascular disease, older adults with diabetes, for example, or smokers. Up to 50% of people who have the disease are believed to be asymptomatic. General surgeons have a financial incentive to amputate. They don't get paid to operate if they recommend saving a limb, and many hospitals don't direct doctors to order angiograms, the most reliable imaging to show whether and precisely where blood flow is blocked, giving the clearest picture of whether an amputation is necessary and how much needs to be cut. Insurers don't require the imaging either. To Dr. Fakhraddin, that was like removing a woman's breast after she felt a lump without first ordering a mammogram. He was determined to make sure that no one else lost a limb before getting the test. This wasn't a controversial view. The professional guideline for vascular specialists, both surgeons and cardiologists, recommend the imaging of the arteries before cutting, though many surgeons argue that in emergency, non-invasive tests such as ultrasounds are enough. Marie Gerhard Hermann, MD and Associate Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School and a cardiologist at Brigham and Women's Hospital, chaired the Committee on Guidelines for the American College of Cardiology and the American Heart Association. She says that angiography before amputation was a view that some of us thought was so obvious that it didn't need to be stated. But then I saw that there were pockets of the country where no one was getting angiograms, and it seemed to be along racial and socioeconomic lines. It made me sick to my stomach. Patients don't know about vascular disease or why their legs dropped or their feet blackened. So Dr. Fakhraddin went to church. He met pastors, and he stood before a pulpit several times each month. He told the crowd that what was happening was an injustice, that they didn't need to accept it. He told them to get screened and to get a second opinion if any surgeon wanted to cut off their limbs. In the lofty Pilgrim Rest Baptist Church in Greenville, he asked the congregation, "How many of you know someone or know of someone who's had an amputation?" Almost everyone raised their hand. At first, Dr. Fakhreddine took a confrontational approach with colleagues. Some seemed skeptical. Excuse me, we ran a computer problem here. Hang on a moment. Pardon me. Well, I'm sorry, I'm taking a second here. We'll get it done. Some seem skeptical that he could prevent amputation. It's a tall claim for complex condition. Over time, though, Dr. Fakhreddine tried to rein in the arrogance. You peeled off a layer that may be composed of, "I'm from up north. I know all you should be thankful we're here to. I know you should all should be thankful we're here to provide services that you probably wouldn't get before," he says. He picked up some southern manners. Dr. Fakhreddine began texting doctors photos of their patients' feet, along with x-rays of their arteries, before his intervention and after. Referrals picked up, and within a year he'd seen more than 500 patients. But Bolivar Medical Center, he learned, was turning away people who couldn't pay a portion of their car revascularization bill up front. It's a for-profit hospital. It's no secret. It's the name of the game, Dr. Fakhreddine said. But a for-profit hospital is the only game in town in one of the most underserved areas. So what happened when a patient comes in and can't afford a procedure that's limb salvage? They eventually lose their limb. A hospital spokesperson said that last year it gave $25 million in charity care, uncompensated care, and insured discounts. Asked whether it turned away patients who couldn't pay for revascularization, they did not respond directly. "We are dedicated to providing care to all people regardless of their ability to pay." At $237 billion in medical costs each year, diabetes is the most expensive chronic disease in the country. One of every four health care dollars is spent on a person in the condition. When it's left untreated, the costs pile on. Medicare spends more than $54,000 a year for an amputee, including follow-up wound care and hospitalizations. Then comes the uncounted tolls, lost jobs, dependence on disability checks, relatives who sacrifice wages to help with cooking and bathing and driving. Dr. Fakhreddine decided that in order to treat as many people as possible, irrespective of income or insurance, he needed to build a lab of his own. Last January, that lab was Henry Daughtry's best shot. The hospital's consulting surgeon expected to amputate his leg below the knee. He had written that because Henry's kidneys were impaired, the contrast dye used in an angiogram would be dangerous. But Dr. Fakhreddine could replace the dye with a colorless gas. After Dr. Fakhreddine told Henry's family his plan, his sister, Judy Daughtry, looked over at her brother who sat slumped over the side of his cot, a blue gown slipping off his bony shoulders. Their father had been a sharecropper, and Henry had dropped out of elementary school to help on the farm, harvesting soybeans, rice, and cotton. Of 10 kids, he was the oldest boy, and he took care of the others, bringing in cash and cooking them dinner. They almost never saw a doctor. Instead, they'd relied on cod liver oil or tea from hog hooves parched over a fire. Henry had spent his career driving tractors, hauling crops, and plowing fields. But he wasn't insured and still rarely saw doctors. At 60, when he was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes and prescribed insulin, he didn't know how to manage the medicine properly. He had never learned to read. Insulin pumps were too expensive, more than $6,000. His blood sugar levels often dropped, and he sometimes passed out or fell on the job. Little by little, his employer cut back his duties. In 2015, he had a stroke. A year later, his right foot blackened and was amputated at the ankle. The infection kept spreading, and soon his lower leg went. He could no longer work. Two of his sisters had died from complications of diabetes. Judy had stood over their beds just as she was now standing over Henry's. "He's still here," she reminded herself. She crossed her arms. "He'll be all right if they don't have to amputate that leg," she said. About every 5 years, the doctors and researchers who make up the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force reassess their screening guidelines. In 2018, the members returned to peripheral artery disease and the blood flow test that Dr. Fakhreddine had asked local doctors to conduct. Once again, the panel declined to endorse them. In its statement, the panel acknowledged that public commenters had raised concern that the disease is disproportionately higher among racial ethnic minorities and the low socioeconomic populations, and that recommendations should perpetuate disparities in treatment and outcomes. Bissano said it needed better evidence. But as the National Institute of Health has found, minorities in America make up less than 10% of patients in clinical trials. Joshua Beckman, M.D., director of vascular medicine at Vanderbilt University Medical Center, was an expert reviewer for the task force, and its report struck him as irresponsible. It hardly noted the advantages of treatment after screening. The benefits were right there in the data. The panel discounted the Stonga study, a randomized controlled trial, which demonstrated that vascular screening reduced mortality and days in the hospital for men ages 65 to 74. The study bundled peripheral artery disease screening with two other tests, but in Dr. Beckman's eyes, the outcomes remained significant. He was confused about why the task force had published its evaluation of screening the general public when it was clear that the condition affects specific populations. Guidelines from several Americans and European professional societies recommend screening people with higher risk. You couldn't test a 25-year-old for breast cancer, Dr. Beckman says. Screening is a target for the group of women who are lucky to get it. Vascular surgeons who study limb salvage have come to see preventive care as perhaps more important than their own last-ditch efforts to open blocked blood vessels. Philip Goodney, M.D., a vascular surgeon at Dartmouth and White River Junction Virginia Medical Center, made a name for himself with research that showed how the regions of the lowest levels of the revascularization, such as Delta, also had the highest rates of amputation. But revascularizations aren't silver bullets. Patients still must manage their health to keep vessels open. Dr. Goodney believes his energy is better spent studying preventive measures such as blood sugar testing, foot checks, and vascular screening. Many patients have mild or moderate disease and can be treated with medicine and counseled to quit nicotine, to exercise, and to watch their diet. We need to build a health system that supports people when they are at risk, when they are doing better, and when they can keep the risk from coming back, he says. And where is a hot spot, that's where we need to focus. Dr. Fakhreddine, along with the Congressional Peripheral Artery Disease Caucus, is pushing for the task force to reevaluate the medicine on screening risk patients, for federal insurers to start amputation prevention programs, and for Medicare to ensure that no amputation is allowed before evaluating arteries. Other groups are advocating for legislation that would require hospitals to publicly report their amputation rates. By early 2020, Dr. Fakhreddine had seen more than 10,000 cardiovascular patients from around the Delta. He was performing about 500 angiograms annually. Last year, he published a paper in Cath Lab Digest describing an 88% decrease in major amputations at Bolivar Medical Center, from 56 to 7. The hospital has different internal figures, which reflect a significant decrease between 2014 and 2017. The hospital recorded that major amputations had fallen 75%, from 24 to 6. Under a crisp, wide sky on Martin Luther King Jr. Day, churches around town were opening their doors for services. Dr. Fakhreddine's office was scheduled to be closed, but he called for his nurses and radiology technicians to staff Henry Daughtry's case. "What's up, young man?" Dr. Fakhreddine greeted Henry, who was fading into his Ambien, and then he handed Judy a diagram of a leg. "The prayer is that we can find this many vessels to open up," he said. "As soon as I'm done, I'll let you know what I find." In the procedure room, he put on his camouflage-patterned lead apron, and with an assistant, he inserted an IV near Henry's waist. He wound a wire across Henry's iliac artery. From the top of the left leg, the femoral artery was open, even though it had hardened around the edges, a common complication of diabetes. They shot a gas down the arteries in Henry's lower leg so that the X-ray could capture its flow. Dr. Fakhreddine looped his thumbs into the top of his vest, waiting for the image. Other than a small obstruction, circulation to the toes was good. "They don't need to whack off the knee," he said, starting at the screen. Henry would lose one toe. After they cleaned out the plaque, Dr. Fakhreddine called Judy into his and showed her a playback of the blood moving through Henry's vessel. She could tell that his foot had enough flow. She folded over, running her palms under on her thighs. "Y'all have done a miracle, Jesus." Henry would need wound care, help controlling his sugars, and a month of rehab. Judy and her daughter would have to learn to manage his antibiotics and find him an apartment. He'd still be able to tinker with his cars, as he did most afternoons. Dr. Fakhreddin scrubbed out. He sat at his desk to update Henry's doctors. He dialed the hospital, asking for one of the nurses, and explained what he'd found. Henry didn't need a leg amputation. Oh, great, the nurse replies. The surgeon was calling and asking about that. He called and tried to schedule one. Dr. Fakhreddin has been typing up notes at the same time, but now he stopped. He was trying to schedule it when, he asked. He was trying to schedule it today. Another article. First person. My school desk. At a bar. It was an unusual place to raise a child, but the characters this boy meets in his dad's saloon gave him a master class in life. I grew up in a bar. When most kids my age were at the park playing ball or riding bikes, I was watching old men shoot pool and play shuffleboard. I saw a barroom fight before I ever saw a sporting event on TV. I don't imagine that Dr. Spock's book on child rearing, which was so popular 50 years ago, advised exposing children to dimly lit drinking at an early age. But lessons can be taught by unlikely teachers in unusual environments. All that is needed are instructions, pure hearts, clear eyes, or optional. My parents owned a neighborhood bar called the M97, named for a nearby highway, on the corner of State Fair and Hoover Avenues in Detroit. Built in the 30s, it had a long wood bar that was on the right as you walked in. It was curved at the end with four-sided lamps, the kind you might see in an old movie about 18th century London. Hung low over the bar every 3 or 4 feet. Customers sat on stools with burnt orange vinyl seat backs or on one of the 6 tables against the wall. Miller was always on tap. My father spent his entire life serving drinks and bringing cheer to an eclectic clientele. There were the white-collar executives who would stop in to unwind from a day's stress. They would bend elbows with the blue-collar and the day laborers on either side of them. It always surprised me that they were able to mingle. Of course, 8 ounces of draft and or any liquor splashed over ice have a way of helping two parties find common ground. I would sit at the last table by the kitchen, sipping Cokes and eating a bag of better-made potato chips with my twin sister watching it all. It was the 1960s version of a reality show. There was Cran, the schoolteacher who always said he graded his sleep-deprived students on an S-curve, handing out passing grades even to those who nodded off because he knew they were making up for sleeping lost in their troubled home lives. If students stayed awake, he received a B. If they slept through class, they got a C. Then there was Big Bill, the tough topic policeman who stood 6.5 feet tall and weighed just shy of a beer truck he drank daily. Bill was not what you would call politically correct. In fact, his views on society could be hard to listen to at times. But one night, he showed that he was all talk. While Bill was on patrol, a call came over the radio about an apartment fire just blocks from his location. He raced his scout car to the scene, beating even the fire crew. The building was ablaze. He ran up 3 flights of stairs through smoke and flames to rescue 2 frightened children. The burly cop carried them out in his arms like each was a carton of eggs. The man with an explosive mouth but a keg-sized heart had saved the day. It's just too bad that Bill wasn't at the bar to stop the man who had a full ashtray of cigarette butts to win a bet. Without a doubt, the most memorable guest of the establishment was a man dubbed the mayor of State Fair Avenue. His parents had named him Frank, but throughout the neighborhood, everyone called him Mr. Mayor. He lived just a rolling beer bottle from the back parking lot, and the bar would light up when the mayor brought the room to session. He had a smooth tongue, smooth enough to talk my teetotaler grandmother into hosting a beer with him. Frank was balding and bespectacled and often wore a cardigan over his slim frame. He was retired from his tool and die shop by the door. By the time he got to know him, he and his lovely wife Eleanor had 9 children, who blessed them with 48 grandchildren and, well, let's just say several great-grandchildren. Frank and Eleanor raised their large brood on his meager salary, but together those 2 people scraped by in the little bungalow that had more bodies than doorknobs. Frank often said, "I don't have a pot to pee in or a window to throw it out of." He still, no matter how much he had to drink, he never went to bed without saying a prayer for the other guy. He told me, and his wife confirmed this, that he never once asked the Lord for anything for himself. A guy without a pot or a window, and with more mouths to feed than the Brady Bunch, never thought to slip a request in to have a C-note or two slide under the front door to make things a bit easier around the old bungalow. Instead, through bloodshot eyes, Frank prayed for someone else every night in his life. They could not bottle enough Kiesler whiskey to make him forego this nightly ritual. Years passed. My father died, and the bar was sold, like a second-hand smoke. The words and the ensemble from that bar stayed with me. One day, a year later, I heard the sad news that the mayor of State Fair Avenue had died. I knew that I had to go to the funeral home to pay respects to the man who had always put the other guy first. I was 2 decades removed from the little boy at the back table, and now working for the post office. The parking lot was full. The streets were lined with cars, and the sidewalk was packed with people waiting to go in the front door. That Sunday afternoon, I couldn't get within 2 blocks of the funeral home. I stood in line smiling in the summer sun, and began reflecting on those long-ago smoking days when I had a front-row seat at the back table at the greatest show on earth. I thought about Cram, the teacher, who realized that tough circumstances can make it more beneficial to rest a weary head on a book than to have a nose planted inside it. I pondered how people can talk one way and act another, even risk their lives as Ben Bill did, the cop did, and how it benefits us all to pay little attention to what people might sometimes say and absolute attention to what they do. A man with a few worldly goods showed me how important it was to care about another's burden than your own. The line of people waiting to pay their respects was the proof. I remember all those old-timers who would flop down in a chair at my table to dole out wisdom above the din of the jukebox. They often told me the same thing, that I would get a better education in the bar than I would ever get from school. These men were right. I certainly have retained more of the wisdom that they imparted to me in the barroom than I ever had from what I learned in a classroom. Party foul. To the person who brought multigrain chips to the party, you could have just said you didn't want to come. Of course, that's better than bringing kale chips to the party. And praise of hitting repeat. Surprising benefits of been there, done that, love it. Scrolling through social media feeds can quickly convince you that everyone's life is more interesting than yours. During a particularly adventurous week on Instagram some months ago, I saw water skiing in Maui, hiking in Yosemite, and swimming with wild pigs in the Bahamas. Wild pigs? Impulsively, I started Googling flights to new places, imagining adventures Then I ordered food from the place I eat at every weekend. Felt bad about not trying somewhere new. This fear of missing out, or FOMO, is rooted in the common tick. Evolutionary were disposed to find novel experiences more exciting than attention-grabbing than repeat experiences, according to research in the Journal of Experimental Biology. That's our fight-or-flight psychology at work. Because our brains can't process all the stimuli around us, we evolved to pay attention to potentially dangerous new things more intently than to familiar things, which we've already established won't hurt us. What's more, words such as repetition tend to be associated with more negative emotions than words like novelty, says Michael Norton, Ph.D., a professor at Harvard Business School. Classic research shows that when we think about upcoming experiences, we think about variety, says Norton. If I ask you right now to select a yogurt for each day next week, you'd pick your favorite flavor, say blueberry, a few times, but you'd mix in some strawberry and peach, because who wants to eat that much blueberry yogurt? Over the longer term, though, as the original experience fades in time and memory, repetition can become more pleasurable. He adds, we're simply more boring than we'd like to admit. Yet because few of us have time or money to regularly indulge in new experiences, we feel bad about our lives' monotony. Recent research shows about repeat and novel experiences in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology suggests that we ought to reconsider those negative feelings. Ed O'Brien, Ph.D., a professor of behavioral science at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business, launched a series of studies on the topic. Many of us happily listen to our favorite song on repeating notes or rewatch favorite movies and TV shows. There's a general belief that if you want to seem like an interesting, cultured person, the best thing you can do is showcase that you've opened new experiences, he says. That may be true, but I think we take for granted the other value of really digging deep into one domain. To test his hypotheses, O'Brien asked his team, and his team exposed all participants to the same stimulus, including museum visits, movies, and video games. Next, some people were asked to imagine repeating the experience, while others actually did repeat what they had done. The researchers found that across the board, participants said that repeating experience was often far more enjoyable than they had predicted. There is joy in repetition, partly because every human mind wonders. Consequently, we wish a substantial part of every experience. As in I'm enjoying a museum or a beer, my mind is also thinking about emails. I need to send, phone calls I need to return, and the name of my third grade teacher, Norton says. So repeating things can really be seen as another opportunity to actually experience something fully. This is especially true when the experience is complex, such as going to a museum or watching a movie, leaving ample room for continued discovery. Our studies show that people are too quick to assume that they've seen all the layers, even in those cases where they haven't, O'Brien says. It's safe to assume that there are more explorable layers in any experience, according to Ellen Langer, Ph.D., a professor of psychology at Harvard University, who is known as the mother of mindfulness. That's because the process of looking for new things, new insights, is fulfilling of and in and of itself. When you're noticing new things in any experience, neurons are firing, and that's the way to become engaged, Langer says. All you need to do is approach whatever task at hand by searching for the things that you didn't see the first time around. If you're unsure about how to be more mindful to repeat the experience, Langer offers three tips. First, recognize that everything is always changing, so the second experience is never exactly the same as the first experience, he says. Second, if you're looking for novelty, that itself is engaging, and the engagement feels good. And third, you must realize that events are neither positive nor negative. It's the way we understand events that makes them positive or negative, she says, so that if we look for ways to experience as rewarding, exciting, interesting, we're going to find evidence for that. Seek and you shall find. Beyond helping the feel excited, the prospect, beyond helping us feel excited at the prospect of strolling around the neighborhood rather than jet-setting at a tropical beach, O'Brien research suggests we should think twice about our cultural obsession with doing and accomplishing much as jubilantly possible. Coffee will never taste as good as it does if you quit for a month, so it's true that novelty is fun, but giving enough of a break in between repeat experiences regains that initial buzz, Norton says. This is why people do seemingly crazy things like creating time capsules. If you look at your third grade report card every day, you'd get sick of it. But if you bury it in a time capsule and unearth it 20 years later, it's fascinating. Howdy, planter. If you walked up to one of the first settlers and said, Howdy, pilgrim, he wouldn't have responded. That's because the settlers reserved themselves as planters to distinguish themselves from adventurers, those who financed the colony, says the website Plymouth.org. It wasn't until the early 19th century that the term pilgrim was used to describe the Mayflower passengers and others who arrived at Plymouth in the early 1600s. And with that, let's switch over to Consumer Reports. Your guide to safer drinking water. Why the government still allows dangerous forever chemicals in America's drinking water, and how you can protect yourself. This is an article by Ryan Felton. In 2014, residents of Harshorn Township, Pennsylvania, near Philadelphia, learned that their water had been contaminated with potentially toxic chemicals linked to an array of health problems, including learning delays in children and cancer. Those residents include Frank and Lisa Penna, who allege in a lawsuit that their water was among the contaminated supplies. Known as PFAS for polyfluoroalkyl substances, the chemicals in this class of approximately 5,000 substances have been notorious as much for their potential danger as for their perseverance. Because the chemical bonds that hold the compounds together don't break down easily, they last a very long time, a reality that has led to a commonly used name for the group, forever chemicals. PFAS compounds are also ubiquitous, used in a range of products, from food delivery boxes to nonstick cookware to stain-resistant clothing. But one of the most troubling routes to PFAS exposure is drinking water that has been contaminated by the discharge from factories and other facilities. Indeed, PFAS have been detected in the drinking water of more than 1,400 communities in 49 states, according to research by the PFAS Project at Northeastern University in Boston and the Environmental Working Group, EWG, an advocacy organization that estimates that 110 million people may have tap water contaminated with the chemicals. The Environmental Protection Agency, which regulates U.S. drinking water, has been investigating PFAS since the late 1990s. It set voluntary guidelines at 70 parts per trillion, PPT, for two of the compounds combined that are the most studied and believed to be dangerous, PFOA, or polyfluoric octet acid, and PFOs, or polyfluoroalkyl substances, polyfluorooctanating sulfuric acid. For context, 1 ppt is the equivalent of 1 grain of sand in an Olympic-sized swimming pool, according to some evidence. But despite the agency's 20-plus years of information gathering, it still has not issued an enforceable nationwide standard on PFAS. The agency has failed to act as even more about the risk of the chemical group has become known, and even as some scientists and environmental organizations have concluded that a far lower concentration of PFAS in water, one ppt, is more than appropriate limit. The EPA won't come in on a proposed 1 ppt limit, saying it would be inappropriate to prejudge the outcome of a regulatory process now underway. But David Andrews, senior scientist at the EWG, says the agency should enact the stringent standard. The scientific research supports the value of 1 ppt lower to be health protective, he says. And an examination by Consumer Reports found that while the EPA's power to regulate chemicals in water is limited, the agency has waffled for years. The EPA hasn't taken a science-based approach to this issue, says Brian Rodholm, CR's Director of Food Policy. It's imperative for Congress to press legislation that establishes PFAS limits in drinking water. The lack of national re-standard has implications that not just for tap water, but for bottled as well. That's because bottled water is overseen by the Food and Drug Administration, which regulates contaminants in bottled water after the EPA set a limit for tap water. CR recently tested 47 bottled waters and detected PFAS in 43 of them. Carbonated waters were more likely to contain PFAS, with several including Topo Chico, Bubbly, and Polar, showing levels that the scientists recommend 1 ppt above the scientific recommended 1 ppt limit. Consumer watchdogs and researchers have long called for action on PFAS. I first asked the EPA more than 19 years ago, what are we still waiting for? A comprehensive national response, says Robert Bielow, an attorney who led a class action lawsuit in the 2000s that accused the chemical company DuPont of contaminating drinking water on the Ohio River Valley with PFAS. That battle, which led to a court-ordered study of 69,000 residents and found significant health risk, was depicted in the 2019 movie Dark Waters. DuPont, while denying any wrongdoing, agreed in 2017 to pay $335 million to settle the dispute. Frank and Lisa Pena, I've seen that movie. It was pretty good. Frank and Lisa Pena, the Horsham Township couple, allege one possible explanation for the EPA's delay. The government itself is a major PFAS polluter and is avoiding substantial cleanup costs. In a 2016 lawsuit, the Penas allege that the PFAS migrated from the Naval Air Station Joint Reserve Base Willow Grove near their home into groundwater. Thousands of gallons of firefighting foam, which contains PFAS, has been dumped into the base during exercises in many years, they allege. The Penas also claim that the rest of their private well found PFOs at PFO levels of 298 ppt and 701 ppt, respectively, up to 10 times the EPA's voluntary limit. The Penas went to trial to August. Part of the government's defense, it can't be held liable because PFAS remain unregulated. Navy spokesperson Lieutenant Gabriel Diamalpo declined to comment on the PEPA case, citing ongoing litigation, but she says the Navy has spent $200 million investigating and responding to potential PFAS concerns and is working collaboratively with our regulatory partners and concerned communities. In their lawsuit, the Penas presented documents that they say show the government knew of the possible risk for PFAS for decades before the EPA moved to curtail their use, a claim the government denies. That includes a 1974 report commissioned by the Air Force that examined how to dispose of aqueous film forming foam, AFFF, the technical name of firefighting foam, used by Air Force environmental personnel, had expressed concern for disposing of AFFs after use. Air Force Lieutenant Ronald Krupp, who led the study, collaborated on those concerns in an August 2019 deposition. It's going in the ground, he said. That is acknowledged, accepted. What wasn't known and needed to be was the impact that might have, he attested. At his deposition, when asked whether the study was conducted to examine the potential impact on drinking water, Krupp said, directly, I cannot say yes. Indirectly, most definitely. The EPA was aware of Krupp's work. In 1980 EPA-funded study, The agency cited the Air Force's earlier report, characterizing it as examining the environmental problem posed by fluorochemicals, another name for PFAS. The following year, DuPont drew headlines when it reassigned about 50 female staffers at a West Virginia plant after learning that a PFAS compound used at the site had been linked to possible birth defects in rats. Years later, in 1999, a former staff scientist at 3M, the company that supplied DuPont with the compound, blew the whistle on his employer for having allegedly withheld crucial information about PFAS. In a resignation letter he dated shared with the EPA, the employee said PFOs is the most insidious pollutant since PCB, referring to polychlorinated biphenyl chemicals now banned for manufacturing purposes. A 3M spokesman directed CR to its website, which says the company phased out the U.S. PFOs and PFAs in the early 2000s, but still uses replacement compounds today. The company has spent $200 million on cleanup efforts from PFAS contamination, the website says. More information about the risks of PFAS continued to emerge in 1999. Research at Oregon State University in Corvallis found that PFAS compounds in groundwater below two military bases years after the military stopped using firefighting foam there. The burdensome law. Part of the problem, researchers say, is that Congress had made it hard for the EPA to act. It wasn't always so. When Congress passed the Safe Drinking Water Act in 1974, it granted the EPA authority to regulate drinking water. Soon after, the agency adopted standards for about two dozen contaminants, according to research by James Salzman, an environmental law professor at UCLA. But over the next two decades, water utilities began to push back, citing the high cost of removing contaminants, and in 1996, Congress amended the Safe Drinking Water Act. The amendments basically gutted the law, making future regulation unlikely, says Eric Olson, Senior Strategic Director of Health and Food at the Natural Resources Defense Council, NRDC, an environmental organization. The EPA says it issued several drinking water regulations to strengthen public health protection since 1996, including revisions for arsenic, bacteria, and water served on airplanes. But since then, the EPA hasn't implemented a new standard for previously unregulated contaminants. The agency has not been able to muster the energy or the political will to jump through all those hoops and regulate a single new chemical through that process in 24 years, Olson says. Regulate as a family. Regulating PFAS presents special challenges for at least two reasons. Thousands of the compounds are already in use, and manufacturers keep introducing new ones, though it's unclear whether they are any safer. As a possible solution to those problems, researchers argued in a June letter to the Journal of Environmental Science and Technology that the government should manage PFAS in a chemical class, in other words, the one standard for all related compounds. It takes 20 years to even consider regulating one, and we've got thousands, says Ed Olson at NRDC. It will be literally geological time before we see regulations of most of them. Worsening the problem is that while some companies have stopped using PFOAs and PFAs, many are replacing them with less studied PFA compounds. The Fluoro Council, an industry group, says that those newer chemicals are safer and that regulating them as a class isn't reasonable because many PFAs chemistries have very different profiles from PFOs and PFOAs. But the letter in Environmental Science and Technology says that the replacement to PFAs can be equally environmentally persistent. Other research has suggested that those replacements are linked to similar adverse effects in human health. The limits of all one-at-a-time approach were underscored by a June study in the Science magazine that looked how PFAs spread underground. EPA researchers found New Jersey soil samples contaminated by new PFAS compounds, one that have their own mouthful of a name, CIPFPECA, ThiPEFCA, or chlorofluorooleic carboxydalate. Now that is a mouthful. The researchers pointed to the chemical company Solvay, which has a facility near where the samples were taken, as the likely source of an accompanying piece. In an accompanying piece, other research tried to find out more about CIPFEC, as the state regulator said their efforts uncovered almost no useful information, which raises more questions than answers. Solvay told CR that it provided toxicology reports on the compounds to New Jersey and to the EPA. The company said those reports, which are not public because they contain proprietary information, show that Solvay is compliant with applicable regulations. But David Andrews at the EWG company compared the scenario to the dearth of information on PFA compounds when they were first discovered. The agency has no public health information on ICPFAs, and we've just assumed the same spot 3 or 4 more decades down the line, he says. The case for a lower level. Advocates and researchers who support the 1 ppt limit for PFAs in drinking water point to growing research, even very small amounts of potential harm, as well as the compound's persistence in the environment. One key piece of evidence is a 2013 study partly funded by the EPA and led by the Harvard Environmental Health Professor Philip Grandjean that shows a decrease in the vaccine responses in children exposed to PFAs. Grandjean's paper recommended a drinking water limit for PTAs of 1 ppt. Last year, the UWG recommended 1 ppt for all PFAs, citing Grandjean's work along with other research associating the compounds with delayed mammary gland development in rodents. The Fluoro Council disagrees. The science does not support a 1 ppt level, the group says. But some experts say even 1 ppt is too high. The NRDC, in a 2019 report, acknowledged that toxicity data is limited, but said that a zero tolerance is needed to provide an adequate margin of safety to protect public health from a class of chemicals that is characterized by extreme persistence, high mobility, and association with a multitude of different types of toxicity at very low levels of exposure. Jamie DeWitt, a PFAS researcher in the Department of Pharmacology and Toxicology at East Carolina University's Brody School of Medicine in Greenville, North Carolina, agrees. We shouldn't have these compounds in the environment, he says. We shouldn't have these compounds in our bodies. Consumers can take some steps to limit their exposure to PFAS, including testing their home water, filtering their water, choosing bottled waters carefully, and avoiding products that contain the compounds. But consumers can't solve the PFAS problem alone, Alisa Cordner, co-director of the PFAS Project Lab at Northeastern University. Though industry hears some responsibility, it's unlikely to act without a government action, she says. Ideally, the EPA should set limits on PFAS in drinking water, says CR's Brian Rodham, because that could take years. Congress should mandate more immediate action, he says. Arlene Bloom, executive director of the nonprofit Green Science Policy Institute, suggested states can act more quickly to tackle the problem. The amount of hoops that the federal government has to go through makes it really difficult, she says. Few states have set PFA limits below the EPA's 70-point advisory, according to American Water Works and Industry Group. In 2019, Vermont set a 20 ppt limit for 5 PFA compounds combined, while New Hampshire proposed past limits of PPA 12 ppt and PFOs 15 ppt, at least 9 others have proposed PFA standards. But Linda Birnbaum, the recently retired director of the National Institute for Environmental Health Science and now a scholar in residence in the Department of Environmental Sciences and Policies at Duke University, says there's an even simpler solution. I keep asking, she says, why the heck are we making chemicals that are never going to go away? What's really in your bottled water? CR tested 47 bottled waters, including 35 non-carbonated and 12 carbonated ones. For each product, we tested 2 to 4 samples. To test fluorosis on 4 heavy metal, arsenic, cadmium, lead, and mercury, plus 30 PFAs, chemicals which pose special concerns because they can linger longer in the environment, almost indefinitely. The federal government has issued only voluntary guidance for PFAs, saying the combined amounts for 2 specific PFAs compounds should be below 70 parts per trillion. A few states have set lower limits of 12 to 20 point ppt, according to America Water Works, an industry group. The International Bottled Water Association, another group, says that it supports the federal limits for PFAs and that bottled water should have PFAs level above 5 ppt for any single compound and 10 ppt for more than one. Some experts say the cutoff for total PFAs level should be even lower, 1 ppt. Lower heavy metal and PFAs leaders. 365 Everyday Water, Alice Bosher, Alkalol, Aquafina, Arrowhead, Boxed Water, Core, Crystal Geyser, Dasani, Estentia, Evian, Fiji Water, Flow, Boat and Getter, Great Value, Ice Mountain, that's from, I'm pretty sure that's from Walmart, Ice Mountain, Just the Basics, Kirkland Signature, that's from Costco, Life Water, Liquid Death, that's interesting, Spring Mountain, Nestle Pure Life, Niagara, Ozarks, Pathwater, Pence, Poland Spring, Saratoga, Smart Water, Trader Joe's, Wickensheen, and Zephyritis. Total PPAs over 1 point, Deer Park, Tourmaline Screen, and Arsic over 3 parts per billion, Starkey Spring Water. Most of the carbonated H2O, lower PFAS level, are sparkling ice, black raspberry, Spindrift. Actually, I've drunk sparkling ice. It's pretty good. Spindrift, Sparkalicious, Dasani, and Schweppes. Total PFAs over 1 point. Perrier, La Croix, Canada Dry, Poland Spring, Bubbly, Polar, and Tapochino. Some big names there. Most of the non-carbonated products CR tested had detectable levels of PFAs, but only two, Tourmaline Spring and Deer Park, exceeded 1 part per trillion. Tourmaline Spring says the amount of PFAs in its bottled water is below the level set by the International Bottled Water Association, an industry group, and all states. Nestle's, which makes Deer Park, said its most recent testing for the brand indicated undetectable levels of PFAs. All non-carbonated water that CR tested had heavy metal levels well below federal safety limits, with one exception, Starkey Spring Water, owned by Whole Foods. It had arsenic levels just shy of the federal limit of 10 parts per billion and more than three times as much as CR's recommended level of 3 parts. The company's highest priority is to provide customers with safe, high-quality, and refreshing spring water, Whole Foods says. These products meet all the FDA requirements and are fully compliant with FDA standards for heavy metal. All carbonated water that CR tested fell below legal limits for heavy metals, and more had arsenic levels above CR's recommendation maximum of 3 parts per billion. But many products have measurable amounts of PFAs. There are a few possible reasons. Phil Brown at the PFAS Project Lab at Northeastern University in Boston says the carbonated process could be a factor. The source water could also have more PFAS, or treatment used by some brands doesn't remove PFAS to below 1 part per trillion. CR heard back from all the companies with PFA levels above 1 part, except for Bubbly, La Croix, and Canada Dry's, said levels in their products are well below the current standards or requirements. Topo Chico, made by Coca-Cola and with the highest PFAS level in CR's test, said it would continue to make improvements to prepare for more stringent standards in the future. Nestle, meanwhile, maker of Poland Spring and Perrier, said its recent testing did not detect PFAS and it supports efforts to set federal limits. La Croix and Polar challenged now CR rave at the total PFA amounts. Brian Rocham, CR's Director of Food Policy, says that PFAs in carbonated water highlights the need for the federal government to set science-based limits on PFAs compounds in tap and bottled drinking water. The fact that so many brands have total PFAs below 1 point shows that it is feasible to get more protective levels, he said. Ways to avoid PFAs in your water. We can't avoid You can't avoid pure and polyfluoroalkyl substances, PFSAs, completely, says James Rogers, PGCR's Director of Food Safety Research and Testing. But several steps can help you choosing water carefully because of there are more things. Check your water. While there are still no federal limits for PFA chemicals in drinking water, certain states require routine testing. If you get your tap water through a public water system, you may get an ammonia report detailing those results. If you didn't receive yours, call the total local supplier. If you rent, call your landlord. The Environmental Protection Agency says it has report systems for 100,000 or more people at EPA government, and you can check a map created by the Environmental Thinking Working Group and Northeastern University that shows contamination with known contamination organization, Preston Fink. Test your water. If your home is not on a public water system or you need more information, get your home water tested. Many do-it-yourself kits are available. It's not always clear what they test for or how accurate they are, so some EPA recommends using a certified lab. To find one, go to epa.gov/DWLab certification. CR also recently tested two home water test services, Simple Lab and Water Check. 27 CR volunteers ordered the kits, collected samples from their homes, and had the water tested for heavy metals and PFAS. The volunteers also sent samples of their water collected to the same time to a CR-qualified independent lab for comparison. Both services yielded accurate results, according to CR's analysis, and users said that both cases, the instructions could have been clearer and results weren't always delivered when promised. And while both were really pricey, Simple Set was better at value. It cost $129 to test for contaminants in municipal water, $134 for well water, and an extra $289 for PFA testing, compared with water checks, $130 for municipal water, $230 for well water, and $400 for PFA, so it ain't cheap. Filter your water. Consumers who learn that their water has high PFA levels could install reverse osmosis filters, which often work best for removing those compounds, as well as other contaminants. But they take up a lot of space and can be pricey. Some costing $1,000 or more. Carbon filters that can be connected to faucets or installed water enters your home can also be effective, although they may work as well for certain compounds. And there's also a warning to choose and use your products carefully. PFAS compounds are found in many products and are particularly common in a few. Included are stain-resistant fabric, and so consider using carpet and familiarization furniture brands that don't use stain-resistant, water-resistant coatings, says Laurel Charter, a scientist at Silent Spring Institute. And with that, we are getting close to running out of time for today's episode of Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. Note that's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. I'm Jim Cronin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. So long until next time, and thanks so much.